Hey, Annie Corrigan here. I'm sitting in one of the smallest studios at WFIU right now. It's one of the few places you can go where it's quiet these days. There's so much activity happening around here because it's our annual fun drive. We're asking listeners to pitch in a few bucks to help us continue bringing you stories about food, recipes, interviews. It's been a really fun year, thanks in large part to our dedicated listeners and fans. So put the coffee on to brew. Then go to WFIU.org/support. You'll be finished with your pledge before the coffee is ready, and it makes such a difference to us. A heartfelt thank you for your support. And now let's get to the show.
Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
What I love about it is that it does not promote the stereotypes of just young girls need to cook. There's a young man in a tie who is cooking some sort of meat. Also, this whole notion of children being invited to the kitchen and teaching children to cook.
Vivian Halloran is talking about the cover photo on the Young America's Cookbook. She's curated an exhibition of books about American food. She'll show us some of the first cookbooks published in America during today's show. Make it yourself deer repellent if you're tired of deer eating your garden. Two stories for harvest season about this year's record corn crop, and then a story about the dying art of picking corn by hand. And a simple snack with Chef Daniel Orr that features radishes. Our news this week includes stories about three food companies making bold pronouncements about transparency and sustainability.
Starting this week, Whole Foods will rate its produce and fresh flowers based upon conservation methods, farm workers' welfare, and pesticide use. Using the system it's calling Responsibly Grown, produce and flowers will be rated as good, better, or best. Responsibly Grown is a multifaceted rating system, including soil health, energy use, waste reduction, sustainable and healthy farming practices, water conservation, and sustainable pest management. For those of you who have always wanted to see how McDonald's makes its food, well, looks like you'll get the chance. This week, the fast food behemoth launched its Your Questions, Our Food campaign. McDonald's is inviting questions via Facebook, facebook.com/McDonald's, and Twitter, @McDonald's. Over the years, McDonald's has faced questions about the ingredients that go into its meals. Remember pink slime? Its North American sales have also been slumping. And Walmart this week rolled out a new initiative aimed at creating, quote, a more sustainable food system, unquote. But critics say such efforts amount to little more than a clever public relations strategy. The company announced it would take steps to reduce the overall true cost of food, increase access to healthy food, improve food safety, and increase transparency about its suppliers and producers. In terms of impact on the food system, Walmart is the heaviest of heavyweights. The company garners $1 out of every $4 that Americans spend on groceries and controls more than half of the grocery market for the 40 top metro areas in the U.S. The company's new initiative sounds pretty good on the surface, but its press statements are short on specifics and measurable goals. Walmart vows to provide nutrition education to 4 million U.S. households starting in 2015. There's no talk of when they expect to reach this goal or how they'll achieve it. The environmental pillar of this new initiative is its Climate Smart Agriculture platform, which the company says will increase visibility of agricultural impacts over the next decade. Stacy Mitchell, a researcher with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, said while there's no way to know for sure whether the company will follow through with this week's moves, history has shown a great gap between the company's talk and its walk. This is greenwashing, but it's a more sophisticated version of greenwashing than we've seen other companies employ in the past. There's more to read about these stories. Find the links on our website and then share them on your Facebook and Twitter. We are at eartheats.org.
And be sure to tag us on your social media @EarthEats. Lou Ann Johnson with our news stories.
Thanks, Annie.
Farmers are bringing in what's expected to be a record-breaking harvest for both corn and soybeans, but all that productivity has a big financial downside. Grant Gerlach of Harvest Public Media explains.
Gene Trausch is in his combine churning through a field of soybeans, and as we move into an irrigated section of the field, things are looking good.
get up in the pivot, then we're in the 70s. Good year for beans. A little bit of corn I've picked is going to be real good also.
Gene and his wife Kelly raise corn, soybeans, and wheat near Minden in central Nebraska. They're hauling in part of what should be a monster harvest nationwide this fall. 4 billion bushels of soybeans, 14.4 billion bushels of corn. Those are record-breaking numbers made possible by farmers planting more corn and soybean acres and near-perfect weather in the Corn Belt. But that achievement comes with a big drawback for farmers. Corn and soybean prices have been falling for months. Grain prices peaked 2 years ago during the drought, but corn that sold then for $8 a bushel is selling for less than half that today.
We outproduced ourselves. You always hope your neighbor burns up, hails out, whatever, dries up, but you have a good crop. You know, that's just the way it works. But everybody had a good crop this year, so.
Prices for corn and beans are at their lowest level since 2009. Farmers like Trausch are responding by holding back as many bushels as possible. At the edge of the field, I'm standing next to these long white plastic bags full of soybeans. They're 10 feet wide, about the length of a football field, like giant soybean sausages. There are a lot of shiny new grain bins and bags like this across the countryside this fall because many farmers are trying to hold their harvest and wait for higher prices.
Last year, we didn't hold on to too much. It all went to town because of the way the markets were, but this year we're going to hold on to just about everything, about 90%. These beans right here, I'll get 30 cents a bushel more by taking them out in January.
With 10,000 bushels of beans in a bag, Trausch can squeeze out an extra $3,000. That makes a difference because it's hard to pay for farming in 2014 on prices from 2009. Corey Walters, an agricultural economist at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, says the cost of farming rose quickly in that short time.
Land, rents, machinery, pesticides, herbicides, everything across the board. Nothing comes to my mind right now that's actually went down.
It's a bad combination. Rising costs, falling prices. Still, Walters says many farmers will have so much grain to sell, they'll manage to make some money. Others will lean on taxpayer-subsidized crop insurance to stay in the black, or close to it.
Does that mean we're going to have, you know, multiple years of low prices and it's all doom and gloom? No, I don't buy that right now.
But until prices improve, farmers who had cash to burn a couple years ago are suddenly pinching pennies, and it's already starting to show.
Well, this is the John Deere 670, S670 combine, and it's a...
Alan Traster shows me a brand new John Deere combine, a towering machine with tires taller than my head and a gleaming paint job.
Yep, it's bright, shiny green. That's what's nice yet, right?
Traster is manager of a machinery dealership near Seward in eastern Nebraska. He says farmers aren't shopping for big-ticket tractors right now.
But with the commodity prices, they're just saying they're just not going to try and do it. I think they're going to hold off.
Equipment manufacturers have seen that coming and are cutting costs. John Deere has announced more than 1,000 layoffs at factories in Iowa. Count Gene Trausch is one of those farmers keeping his money on the sideline. He says his farm is on solid ground financially, but he predicts others may not be able to weather a prolonged downturn.
There's going to be guys that will not be able to make it. You know, the ones that did go buy lots of high-priced ground or overextended on new equipment, or if you're a young guy that just got into farming and just don't have the resources.
For them, he hopes things go back up as quickly as they came down. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
In the second half of our show, the dying art of picking corn by hand. Another story from the reporters at Harvest Public Media. Chef Daniel Orr is in the kitchen for us today. In addition to his culinary adventures, he's also an avid gardener. And just like anyone else growing food, he struggles with pest control, specifically deer. Anyone ever looked out their window to see deer munching on their plants? Yeah, it's a problem. Daniel recently planted some fruit trees in his garden.
Some apples, pears, plums, and they attacked them one night and just ate all the leaves off those poor little trees. So that's what got me inspired to make this.
It's a repellent made from stuff you probably already have in your kitchen.
So I call it Not Tonight Deer. And hopefully that keeps the deers away from your fruit trees and your plants in the garden. And it's really simple. And what you want to do is you want to let it kind of brew for a little while so it kind of really develops a little bit of a stink to it. And you may not want to use this on your plants right by your front door, but the ones that the deers attack out towards the edges of the garden, you might want to use this. Now, what I've got here is just a plain old egg, and I'm going to crack that into a blender. Add some fresh chilies, and you want to use the hotter the better.
And while you're taking the stems off, you are not bothering to take the seeds out because you want
to... No, we want it to be hot. Add about a quarter cup of buttermilk. You could use yogurt or plain milk, but the buttermilk seems to go rancid a little bit quicker.
Which is what we want?
Yes. And then we're going to add some garlic. If you have some dried out old cloves, you can use those up in this kind of a preparation. And throw that in the blender. And then we'll add about a quart of water to this, and then you can mix another 2 quarts in at the end, so you have about 3 quarts of spray.
So essentially you're making the concentrate right now?
Yes, exactly. All right, so we're going to give this a whiz. Now let that rip until everything gets nicely combined. And you can also, if you want to, add just a little bit of salad oil, about a tablespoon to a gallon. And what that will do is that will help it stay on the tree. It will coat it and make it stick to the tree a little bit better. All right, once that's nicely pureed, we're going to add that to a jug with 2 more quarts of water. You can give that
a smell.
Take a deep whiff, and you're going to get those chilies in your nose. It smells a little bit like a green goddess dressing, but believe me, once this sits for a day or two outside at room temperature, it's going to develop a real strong aroma. Believe me, it'll keep the rabbits, the deers, and other little critters away from your tender little lovely garden plants.
Find this recipe at eartheats.org. Vivian Halloran loves to eat. She's right up front about that. Her research took a turn toward food when she discovered a book about slave food when she was in Barbados. She's from Puerto Rico, so she says it was an interesting supplement to her own food life in the Caribbean. She then became interested in American food traditions, so she's organized an exhibition at the Lilly Library called Book Bites, texts that influenced and reflected how America eats. Part of what she wanted to combat is the notion that there is no such thing as American cuisine.
And so I wanted to dig in deep and see what the origins of where do people start claiming Americanness along with specific food ways. And so I did some research and came up with the first cookbook published in the United States, which is this tiny little one.
It's tiny. It looks like it could be a little hymnal in a church from 1796. Is that right?
Yeah. This was primarily an adaptation of cookery books that had British recipes, but it's the first effort to really incorporate local ingredients, like corn figures prominently. And corn had been embraced out of necessity because the British really preferred wheat. But wheat wasn't inherently easy to grow in this new terrain. So a lot of dishes incorporating locally grown food crops like corn and then meats like turkey were gradually what distinguished America, the emerging American cuisine during colonial times and the early foundational period from the British and European food waste that people have brought with them.
Do we still make some of these recipes, maybe with some changes?
Yes. Just meat and potato type of meals are still there, and soups, and cakes, obviously. But there's also things we thankfully don't make.
Oyster ketchup.
We don't tend to think of ketchups as being anything other than tomato-based, but there are a lot of ketchups, and that's just a general category of mushed up, you know, there's walnut ketchups, there's clearly oyster ones.
Well, let's see here. It's quite a domestic sauce and very good. Serve it up under lamb, veal, or sweetbreads.
If you're eating sweetbreads, I think anything's on the table. I mean, so then the American taste for sweets shown in 1918
book. Wartime breads and cakes.
Yeah, that kind of recaps the war effort and how American cooks were urged to display their gastronomic citizenship, right? Their patriotism through the way in which they used the few materials they were allowed to cook with, and to nonetheless infuse the sense of the domestic with an idea of normalcy through the serving of desserts.
Looking in that same window at the exhibition is a food book for kids, Young America's Cookbook, which features a striking color image on the cover.
And I chose it because most of the illustrations for cookbooks at this time were not in color and were not photographs. And what I love about it is that it does not promote the stereotypes of just young girls need to cook. There's a young man in a tie who is cooking some sort of meat. And then there's a younger boy who is looking appealingly at the cakes his sister wearing this apron is doling out and letting cool. Also, this whole notion of children being invited to the kitchen and teaching children to cook as part of their education, their civic duty, and also their place in the family.
You can see the cover photo of this Young America's Cookbook on eartheats.org. Vivian Halloran is an associate professor of American Studies and English at Indiana University. More from my conversation with her at the Lilly Library coming up then.
Simplicity is everything in good cooking. I think that, you know, 90% of being a great chef is being a good shopper and 10% not screwing up what you bought.
Some solid advice there from Daniel Orr. He has a recipe for us that's just 4 ingredients, but it packs an amazing flavor punch. That's coming up in 10 minutes. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats, hello. I'm Annie Corrigan in the Lilly Library with Vivian Halloran, looking at the Book Bites exhibition.
Tell me about this one. Good things to eat, as suggested by Rufus.
Rufus Estes was one of the first people to acknowledge his background as a slave. He was born as a slave, and then he made his living. He became a professional cook in the railway. So he would cook for presidents. He would cook for very important luminaries. And the receipts, because that's what we used to call recipes, are all very practical, and they're aimed towards people who want to break into food service as a career. And so I like the fact that it's his knowledge. I love his image, and I wanted to proudly display the fact that he self-published this, and it became very popular because he had a very well-established reputation as a good cook of fine food.
When did this come out? Can we see 1911?
Yes. This is before the First World War, and while the railroads were the primary means of luxury travel from the north to the south and across, it's a way in which African Americans could get out physically out of the South, but also make and acquire skills and be independent contractors and have their skills be the source of their good reputation. They were not beholden to anybody but the company. And the company took great pride in promoting Rufus.
As suggested by Rufus is the subtitle of this book. Was this guy known by his first name at the time?
Yes, and there's some issue as to, I mean, the fact that he was able to self-finance this and it got distributed and has not been forgotten in the history books. My path to finding him was not very difficult at all. I have at home a paperback edition, like a Dover edition of Rufus's Good Things to Eat. So that attests to how well he was known and how popular the book became. Because again, there are just concise lists of ingredients and specific techniques. So this was how you became educated to work in these kinds of professional cooking scenarios. Also, though, it is one of the very few of these types of books that has a personal note. And he has 2 or 3 pages in here that he talks about being born a slave and having to help out the family after emancipation.
Did he talk about what his food life was like when he was a slave?
he did not have a very varied diet. So what he skips over is how he became so well acquainted with fine food. I suspect that he worked in the kitchens of the well-to-do families in the neighborhood. But I wanted to highlight the fact that culinary expertise was not limited to white people with money, and it wasn't limited to women.
Vivian Halloran talking about Rufus Estes's Good Things to Eat on display at the Lilly Library. We'll continue our trek through the history of American food books with Professor Halloran next week. It's harvest time, and that means farmers all over the Midwest are bringing in billions of bushels of corn. With modern technology, they can strip acres in a day. But corn used to be harvested by hand. And Harvest Public Media's Abby Wendell went to the one place where that kind of technology isn't obsolete.
Frank Henenfent stands like an athlete. His feet apart, knees bent, back firm. He's squared off against a field of corn.
7, 6, 5.
As the announcer counts down, he takes hold of his first ear.
1. Begin.
Henenfent begins picking the corn with his hands. He slices through the corn husk with a hook that's attached to his palm with a leather strap. Then he snaps the golden ear off its stalk and tosses it over his shoulder into a wagon following alongside him. Most days, Henenfent is a typical Illinois farmer. At this time of year, that means he drives an air-conditioned, GPS-equipped combine, a machine that can harvest as many as 12 rows of corn at a time. But today, Henenfent is going back to the basics. He's a top competitor at the 34th annual Illinois State Corn Husking Competition.
When I pick corn, I totally lose myself in it.
As he makes his way down the row, corn flies through the air. He's establishing his beat.
Just kind of get that rhythm and that place where you're in a trance and that's all you're thinking about. And you don't really hear anybody around you or anything. It's just next ear, next ear, next ear.
The contest is held in a cornfield in Roseville, a rural community in western Illinois. It's one of several competitions happening at this time of year across the Midwest. Here, about 250 people have come from as far away as the suburbs of Chicago to watch. Grade schooler Sam Monroe says she's here specifically to see Frank Henenfent.
He lives just right across the field from us, and my dad says that I have to be trained by him, and so I can enter the competition next year.
There are several races throughout the day, ranging from 2-minute-long peewee contests for the kids to 20-minute matches for those 50 and up.
Pull it down. Now, don't drop that hand. Just hold on to that husk.
In preparation for the 50 and up event, a group of men lean in to watch Dick Humes. He's giving them a last-minute lesson.
See there?
Down. I'm still not getting it.
Some of Humes' students remember a time when harvesting corn by hand wasn't a sport. It was a way of life. Don McKinley grew up in the 1930s in southwestern Iowa on a farm with 100 acres of corn. During the harvest, McKinley would drop out of school for 2 months to help his older brothers and dad. The 5 men picked from before sunup till after dark.
Now, as I look back, Mom and Dad never had any worry about the kids running around at night. We were so damn tired you couldn't. We'd just fall over into bed and collapse, get up the next morning, do it all over again.
He says each of them brought in about 4,500 pounds a day. That's a lot of corn. Still, McKinley's run the numbers, and they show that a man simply can't compete with a machine. In 1937, John Deere came out with a number 10 corn picker that picked as much as 4 Don McKinley's. And today, a big combine like the one a typical Illinois farmer uses brings in close to 200,000 pounds an hour. You would need an army of over 2,000 men to keep up.
And that's in my lifetime. In my lifetime. 10 bushel an hour working your butt off. To sitting in that cab, going through your field and shelling 4,200 bushel in an hour. Now that's evolution. That's, my dad would turn over in his grave if he knew that there was a machine that could pick that much.
Back in the cornfield, Frank Henenfent is finishing his race. He made it farther down the row than anyone else, and he's attracted a crowd. Ardith Claire watches in awe.
It doesn't seem like he's hurrying. I mean, he's got one hit in the bumper board, one in the air, and he's got his hand on the third one. And he's just like a machine.
By the end of his race, an infant had picked 450 pounds of corn in 20 minutes. It might not be good enough to compete with John Deere, but it will take him to the national competition held later this month in Iowa. Abby Wendell, Harvest Public Media.
More stories at harvestpublicmedia.org. I always thought radishes were a spring thing, but as I was walking around the farmer's market last week, there were radishes for sale. Come to find out, winter radishes come in many varieties. You may have heard of daikon radishes, but what about black Spanish or China rose? As you would expect, they all possess unique flavor qualities. Some are very spicy, some are more mild. Sounds like maybe a winter radish taste test is in order. Chef Daniel Orr made this recipe for us in the spring using French breakfast radishes, but this dish could be just as tasty now in the fall. Just find that winter radish that suits your taste. Take a listen.
All right. Well, simplicity is everything in good cooking. I think that, you know, 90% of being a great chef is being a good shopper and 10% not screwing up what you bought. So the radish, the old French radish and butter sandwich is about as simple as you can go. We're going to fancy it up just a little bit. I've got my great-grandmother's biscuit recipe we're going to use instead of bread, but you could use any kind of bread. And I'm just going to slice those into some rustic chunks. Okay, I'm just going to put a nice, real nice slab of butter. I mean, this isn't something where you're going to be meek with your butter. And use a good creamery butter. I use unsalted because we're going to be using the sea salt, and we're going to be using Himalayan sea salt. If you've seen that before, it's got that nice pink color. For the radishes, I'm going to cut them into julienne, which means little matchsticks. And that just makes them look pretty, and you can stick them on the toast easier that way. So we're just going to mound those up on those biscuit croutons, and then we'll sprinkle them with the salt. So those are our little French breakfast radish croutons. I'm garnishing it with a little local kale and some dill. Simple as can be.
Love these. Next week, we'll be working with radishes again, but we'll be preserving them with some of that sea salt. Don't miss a single recipe from Earth Eats. Subscribe to our weekly podcast on iTunes. Our Earth Eats crew is a hardworking bunch. Ebon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, Casey Zakin, and the reporters at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Good times again this week. Sustainable, local, simple. Earth Eats. One last thing. When you visit eartheats.org, you'll see a red Give Now button in the upper right. Click that, then choose to support WFIU Public Radio. That's where Earth Eats lives. A couple of minutes and a couple of dollars every month. It does make such a difference in our little corner of the local and sustainable food world. Thanks for being there for us. Till next time, I'm Annie Corrigan.